This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
As we found out from Fukushima, when a nuclear reactor blows up or leaks, it's everybody's problem. Many of my listeners were sprinkled with radiation from that accident in Japan in 2011. The same applies to nuclear waste. It will be dangerous for hundreds of thousands of years, threatening cancers and genetic mutations for all conceivable human time, just so we can waste more power now in our homes and businesses. This week, we hear about scandals in the American and British nuclear industry. Even the temporary stopgap solutions for storing waste turn out to be untested, ludicrous, or known to be dangerous. They, or is it we, do it anyway. Our descendants have to figure out an answer. They will pay and pay like a kind of debt slavery from the past for tending the nuclear waste of today. After a successful lawsuit brought by four environmental groups, the American nuclear industry must provide an environmental risk assessment for nuclear waste. Some say the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is evading the ruling and the requirement of local democracy by ramming through a one-size-fits-all generic risk assessment for all the nation's power plants. One assessment, even though they're all different. You will hear two points of view from the NRC hearing in Perrysburg, Ohio, and I'll talk with longtime anti-nuclear activist Kevin Camps about the fallacy of safe storage for highly radioactive waste. Is Britain doing any better? Another veteran, nuclear engineer John Large, tells us about the growing mountain of plutonium in the UK and the big risks of nuclear terrorism. This isn't going to end well. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. There are many scandals lurking in the nuclear industry, stories that you need to hear. My journey for this program began in the unlikely place of Perrysburg, Ohio. It was there the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, was pretending to listen to the public before proceeding with their plan. They want to bypass any further local democratic input when it comes to how reactor owners can store their nuclear waste. Free Speech Radio news reporter Evan Davis was there recording it all. Evan sent me the audio, and it made my skin crawl. And as I dug deeper, I found a second scandal, I think. It's about those dry casks for spent nuclear fuel. Everyone says we need dry casks. We'll talk about the perils of trying to get rid of nuclear waste with longtime campaigner Kevin Camps. Kevin is from the group Beyond Nuclear. He's been digging into obscure nuclear documents and companies for decades. Kevin goes to uranium mining towns, to reactor sites, anywhere people confront the nuclear industry. Kevin Camps, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
So you were among the many who got exactly 3 minutes to talk to the NRC reps in Perrysburg, Ohio. What's the background and what is the NRC trying to do?
Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is under federal court order to carry out an environmental impact statement on high-level radioactive waste generation, the risks of on-site storage in indoor pools and outdoor dry casks, the risks of moving the waste to away from reactor parking lot dumps, and even the likelihood or the lack thereof of a repository, a deep geologic repository, ever being opened to, you know, permanently dispose of high-level radioactive waste. So the NRC is doing this kicking and screaming under court order, and they're actually defying the court order because they have not analyzed the risks. What they've done instead is they've simply assumed safety at every turn. So what they're hoping to get away with is just a blank check to the nuclear industry to keep on making as much high-level radioactive waste as it wants.
And it sounds like they want just one generic environmental assessment for all the different sites, but it seems like those sites are very different. I mean, you've got Diablo Canyon Reactor built right near an earthquake fault, and then you've got Indian Point, just 38 miles from America's biggest city, New York City. How can they say, well, it's all the same, so we just need to do this once?
Well, you're absolutely right, and we heard that. There were about a dozen of these field hearings around the country to collect public comment, but like you said, they only gave people 3 minutes. The common theme we heard across the country was site-specific risks. I mean, at the Perrysburg, Ohio hearing, there was a lot of testimony about the Davis-Bessey atomic reactor just east of Toledo, the Fermi nuclear power plant in southeastern Michigan. So wherever you went in the country, one ironic thing about the example you chose, Diablo Canyon and Indian Point, after Fukushima, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was forced to admit that the nuclear power plant most at risk of an earthquake in the United States is very likely Indian Point in New York. It's because there are earthquake fault lines nearby that were not known about when the plant was built. So the plant was not built very robustly. And if that earthquake ever were to go off, then Indian Point could be in a very bad way.
Now, this reexamination comes because of a lawsuit brought by activists. Can you tell me about that?
It was a tremendous legal victory. It was won by four environmental groups, Blue Ridge Environmental Defense League, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, Riverkeeper, and NRDC. And also four states were a part of that victory, the states of New York and Vermont and Connecticut and New Jersey. And the D.C. Court of Appeals, the second highest court in the land, ruled in June of 2012 that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had to undertake an environmental impact statement, even though we are 50 years into commercial nuclear power in this country. It's incredible. They've never looked at the environmental risks of generating high-level radioactive waste.
I want to get back to this Perrysburg hearing again, but before I do that, I want to talk to you about the ways that we handle spent fuel. Now, people are very worried about keeping the nuclear fuel in pools and that those pools are filling up. Can you talk to us about those risks briefly?
Well, the pools are catastrophes waiting to happen, and the poster child for this is Fukushima Daiichi Unit 4, which was severely damaged. Even though it was not operating, its reactor was empty of fuel. But the building was severely damaged by a hydrogen explosion. Hydrogen gas flowing over from Unit 3 is the official version. And the danger is another big earthquake could bring that entire Unit 4 building down, including the high-level radioactive waste storage pool located about 60 feet up in the air. And if that were to happen, the pool could lose its cooling water. It could drain away, and the waste in the pool could catch on fire. It would dwarf the radioactivity releases that we've already seen in the past nearly 3 years at Fukushima Daiichi by an order of magnitude, because there's no radiological containment around the storage pool. The same is true here in the United States. In fact, our pools are packed much more full than that Japanese pool is, several times more waste in our pools here in the U.S. No radiological containment. You've got the risk of pool drain downs, sudden drain downs as by an earthquake or the dropping of a heavy load or a terrorist attack. You've also got a slower motion catastrophe, a pool boil down, which is where the electric grid is lost. You're not getting electricity to the pumps running the cooling system on the pool. And you could slowly, over the course of days or a couple weeks, boil the water down to the fuel, and then it could catch on fire.
And they have to have some sort of battery backup, I assume, or diesels. But we can see points where both of those could go wrong, as they did at Fukushima Daiichi.
Well, to show you how incredibly lax the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is on pool storage, they do not require emergency backup power to be attached to the pools. So when the grid is lost, and it's happened where pools begin to warm up in the United States, but the grid was restored in time to restore the cooling circulation to the pools. But, you know, it's one of the calls that we have made, and large numbers of environmental groups have called on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to require emergency backup power, not only on cooling the reactors, but also on cooling the pools. And they've yet to take that action.
Oh, my. I can't believe it. They have no backup in case the power goes out, and it goes out pretty regularly. Well, since these reactor pools are full of spent fuel, they are dangerous, as we've talked about. There's a drive to get the fuel rods out of the pools and into big cement canisters called dry casks. And people I respect are pushing this, and I thought it was a good idea until just a couple of weeks ago. Now I find, partly through you, there are big problems with dry casks as well, and the public have not been told about it. What are these risks?
Well, it's interesting. It's how I got involved in nuclear power issues to begin with back in 1992. I lived in southwest Michigan near the Palisades Atomic Reactor, and it was the first plant in the country to be allowed to simply do its thing with dry cask storage. They built their dry cask storage on a sand dune in shoddy casks with defects. And so I learned very quickly how out of control this all is. The risks of dry casks are there's really an utter lack of quality assurance on their design and manufacture. So we have very questionable structural integrity to begin with. This isn't just with one cask model like at Palisades. It's with all of them. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is just out of control. Some more problems are there's no monitors on the casks at this point, no heat monitors, no pressure monitors, no radiation monitors. They rely on workers walking by maybe every 2 weeks is as often as they go by to see what's going on with the casks. So you could have a problem going on and not even know it for a couple weeks. And then you've just got the simple problem of being out in the elements and corrosion eventually over time failing these casks and releasing their contents into the environment. And you've also got the fact that they're not designed to withstand terrorist attacks. There was a test done at U.S. Army Aberdeen Proving Ground here in Maryland back in 1998, an anti-tank missile fired at a German dry cask, which are much better than American dry casks in many ways. And it blew a hole clean through the wall of the cask. So that's now the escape pathway for the radioactivity. You combine an explosive like that with an incendiary, and now you have ignited the zirconium cladding on the fuel rods, and the release would be disastrous. But I should hasten to add that pools, as I mentioned, can sometimes have something like 600 tons of waste in them. But the dry casks are going to divide that up into about 10-ton packages. So if attackers were to try to do that with dry casks, you know, it'd be much easier to catastrophically release radioactivity from a pool because there's so much in one place. So as I said, you know, dry casks are not safe, but they are safer than these catastrophically vulnerable pools.
Now, is it true that American fuel pools at reactor sites are filling up, making dry casks the only current option?
Well, also said at all these hearings was we need to stop making it. That's the only solution. But as reactors do operate, what's happened is, you know, by the year 2015, all of the pools in the United States are going to be full to capacity, which means if they're going to keep operating, what they have to do is they have to have room in the pool for the next offload of core fuel coming out so that fresh fuel can be put in the reactor core. A third of the core is emptied every couple, 3 years. So what they do in the industry by standard practice is take out as little fuel from the pool as they can to make room for that next fuel offload. So yeah, they're going to have to turn to dry cask storage at what few plants don't have it yet. What's incredible about this, the reason they do it that way, is they're trying to defer dry cask storage costs as far into the future as possible by keeping the pools as full as possible. What that means is they're maximizing the risk of a pool fire by doing that, and they're just doing it to save money.
And do all the reactors in the United States have enough space in their fuel ponds to hold the current fuel rods if there was an accident? They had to empty the reactors out fairly quickly. Do they have a place to put that stuff?
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission does have a requirement that there be enough space in the pool for a full core offload. But another shortcut on safety that we've seen recently, and it's a precedent, so it's probably going to be applied at other nuclear power plants with multiple reactors. At Prairie Island in Minnesota, a two-reactor site, the NRC said you just need enough room in the pool for one core offload. So the question is begged, what if both reactors are in an emergency and both cores have to be offloaded quick? They don't have room in the pool for both cores.
Well, come on, Kevin. There's no way that two reactors or more are going to get into trouble at the same time.
Well, I tell you, Fukushima Daiichi was a wake-up call to the entire world that, you know, we used to fear a single reactor catastrophe like Three Mile Island or Chernobyl. And little known at Chernobyl is that that almost spread to four reactors. It took some heroic actions that cost workers their lives to prevent fire from spreading to all four reactors at Chernobyl. Well, they weren't able to stop the spread at Fukushima Daiichi, so we saw three reactor meltdowns and, you know, multiple pools at risk at Fukushima Daiichi.
So how long can nuclear waste stay in these dry casks before we have to open them up and transfer the materials? And is there any reason we might want to open them up ahead of that time?
Well, it's a part of the absurdity of the NRC's nuclear waste confidence policy, as they call it. We call it a nuke waste con game. They are assuming in this document that the dry cask storage is going to be replaced in its entirety, perhaps as often as once per century. And when we ask them point blank, how long would this replacement assumption go into the future, they said forever. They have no cutoff point on that, which, you know, it's just absurd. So they're assuming, without giving a price tag for how much it would cost or any idea of where the money would come from or who's responsible for it, that once every 100 years, the dry cast storage at the nuclear power plant sites across the United States will simply be replaced in its entirety from top to bottom.
But if we want to open up something like Yucca Mountain or some, you know, central transport place, then would we have to open up the casks to transport the nuclear materials?
Yes, we sure would. Many of the casks currently loaded, and I believe the figure is 1,700 dry casks in the United States at this point, are not certified for transportation. Like the ventilated storage casks at Palisades in Michigan I mentioned, they are for storage only. There's a growing number of dual-purpose casks that are out there now. For example, the Holtec cask model, which is certified for storage on site as well as transportation. But even those would have to be opened and the inner canister removed with a transfer overpack for radiation shielding in order to insert that inner canister containing the waste into a transportation shipping overpack. And to the best of my knowledge, there's never been a single dry cask unloaded once loaded in the United States.
They're putting them in these casks, but they've never tested unloading them, and the industry's never done it.
Yes, and in fact, at Palisades, the company, Consumers Energy, and the NRC perjured themselves, in our humble opinion, before a federal judge and said, don't grant an injunction against the loading of these dry casks. If there's a problem, we will simply unload them by reversing the loading procedure. And the lie was put to that just a year later in 1994 when they admitted the fourth cask to be loaded at Palisades was defective, and they said, to live up to our word, we're going to unload it back into the pool. Here we are, almost 20 years later, they have never unloaded that cask. They ran into the very technical difficulties that we warned them about in the first place.
That it would be too hot to put back in the pool, or what was the problem?
Well, there's multiple problems. One is there are pressure-fit shims under the lid that they don't even know how to deal with. They still don't, and we're 20 years into the thing. Then you have to race a clock. You only have 40 hours once you disrupt the cooling mechanism on the dry cask to get the waste back into the pool. They could not beat that clock. And the final challenge would be the waste is some 400 degrees Celsius, which is 750 degrees Fahrenheit in the dry cask. They would be putting it back into the pool, which is 100 degrees Fahrenheit water. You would cause a radioactive steam flash because there are radioactive contaminants in the pool water. That would be a danger to the workers, and the pools are not radiologically isolated from the outside atmosphere either, so there'd be a release. And then be a thermal shock to the waste, that huge temperature differential.
And now we've got a new wrinkle where the industry has been sort of doubling the capacity of their fuel. It's extra hot fuel, and they're still putting it in the old dry cask design. Can you talk to us about that?
There is a tremendous buzz in the United States now about what's called high burn-up fuel, even though they've been allowing it for a couple decades at this point. It means using more enriched nuclear fuel to begin with and then keeping it in the reactor core longer to extract as much electricity as possible and to decrease the number of refueling outages, which get in the way of making profits from electricity sales at the utilities. But what it means is the waste that's coming out of the reactor cores is more radioactive, it's more thermally hot, and just to give listeners an idea of the difference, low burn-up fuel, as it's called, from decades past, has to stay in the pools for at least 5 years before removal to dry casks. It has to radioactively decay and thermally cool for those 5 years. High burn-up fuel has to stay in the pools for 10 years. I've even heard the figure of 20 years for some high burn-up fuel. Has to stay in the pool that long before it could be moved to dry casks. And you asked about the certification for transportation. That is an open question on high burn-up fuel, the transportation certification requirements.
And I found the Argonne National Laboratory and the Department of Energy are completely aware the current dry casks can't safely hold today's nuclear waste. They're spending $16 million to find solutions, including adding instruments to find out what is happening inside. And Kevin, I was horrified on two counts. First, that tells me they don't know the current state of the fuel rods inside those up to 1,700 casks already filled. And second, the industry continues to fill dry casks they know may never be able to be unloaded safely. Can you talk to us about those two points?
You're absolutely right. You know, when I was taking science in public school in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and also at college, you know, it was important to have a number of data points so you could feel confident that your findings were accurate. there are very few data points as to what's going on inside even the low burnup fuel storage casks in the United States. They've had some studies that were aborted prematurely. They knew that there were problems, like there have been seal leaks at the Surry Nuclear Power Plant in Virginia, which is the oldest dry cask storage we have in the United States. So there's worries about degradation of the fuel, but there's been very few checks on how it's going. This Argonne and DOE and EPRI study to put an instrumented lid onto a single dry cask by the year 2017, it's a very good idea. It actually is a part of a call by environmental groups across the country for monitors on the dry casks. As I mentioned, the heat monitors, the pressure monitors, the radiation monitors, humidity monitors. That's exactly what we're calling for. And so I'm glad that the nuclear establishment is finally some 30 years into dry cask storage getting around to it. But it's incredible that it's only a single cask. They're just now beginning this process. This should have been deployed from the very beginning.
So just to make this clear, the American nuclear industry and other countries like the United Kingdom are using dry casks that have never even once been opened, hardly tested, and they're known to be unsafe for current reactor fuel. Am I right about that?
Yeah, the high burnup fuel is an open question, a huge question mark. If these standard dry, I mean, there's real problems and concerns and risks with the low burnup fuel in the dry casks. So now they're loading high burnup fuel of more potency, more radioactivity, more heat into these same containers. And another issue with the dry casks is this quality assurance violation issue. Whistleblowers in industry and at the NRC have really exposed the dirt on the Holtec casks, which are nearly half the casks in the United States. They question the structural integrity of the Holtecs sitting still in storage at the reactor sites, let alone going 60 miles per hour or faster on the rail lines, because these are rail casks that weigh over 100 tons.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm talking with Kevin Camps. He's been studying and fighting schemes for nuclear waste storage for decades. Kevin, it sounds like these casks are almost a pretend answer, a way to stall the whole problem for future humans, and then find out the brittle fuel rods will fall apart when they open them up. What are we supposed to do with high-level waste?
Well, the call from a coalition of environmental groups across the country, some hundreds of groups representing all 50 states, is for hardened on-site storage where appropriate. And what that means is dry cask storage, yes, emptying the catastrophically vulnerable pools into dry cask storage, but dry cask storage that is well-designed, well-built, well-maintained, well-monitored, with top-notch nuclear grade, as it's supposed to be, quality assurance and quality control. Casks that are designed against terrorist attacks, casks that are designed to last not decades but centuries. None of that is happening. Our call for hardened on-site storage, which began in 2002 as an alternative to the Yucca Mountain dump votes in Congress that year, has fallen on deaf ears at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, at the Department of Energy, on Capitol Hill, at the White House. We keep it up. We do our best. I think we're shining a very bright spotlight on this issue, but the decision-making is abhorrent.
And we started with a meeting of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in Perrysburg, Ohio. And Kevin, it was pathetic hearing so many citizens angry with the whole process, trying to contain their objections into just 3 minutes. Does the NRC listen? And do you think this generic environmental assessment plan will go through?
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is a captured agency. It's a rogue agency, completely captured by the industry it's supposed to be regulating. And because it's so in defiance of the court order, I think that there's a very good chance that this thing is going back to court. And so our challenge is to load the record. I mean, this is our opportunity to submit public comments up until December 20th. They're still open to written comment submissions. So we're loading the record, very likely going back to court. The danger is that NRC may finalize this environmental impact statement late next year, 2014, and then just race through whatever remaining licensing is left in this country. 20-year extensions at old reactors, new reactor license applications. That is how cynical they are. Just get it done and hope that they beat the next court ruling against them.
So this opens the door, possibly. They say, well, we've got a good storage solution. We'll just maybe even build new reactors if we want to.
This is carte blanche. This is a green light to make as much high-level radioactive waste as the industry wants. And it's a curse on all future generations because we don't know what to do with it. These are just holding patterns, and as we've been discussing, they're not very good ones at all.
Kevin Camps, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Well, another risk that we're facing, we call the mobile Chernobyl, or dirty bombs on wheels, or floating Fukushimas. This is a bill in the U.S. Senate, and we've seen it before. We've seen it for the past 20-plus years that would just start the high-level radioactive waste moving by truck, by train, by barge, even on the Great Lakes, on Lake Michigan, and move it to what we call parking lot dumps, what the establishment calls centralized interim storage. And the targets for centralized interim storage are Native American reservations, Department of Energy sites that are already badly burdened with radioactive waste, perhaps even nuclear power plants like Dresden in Illinois. So that's the next big fight on Capitol Hill, is to try to stop the mobile Chernobyl, because it solves nothing except it gets the liability off the ledgers of the utilities and puts it squarely on the back of the American taxpayer.
I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest has been Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear. Find them at www.beyondnuclear.org. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Alex.
Find links for this interview in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info, and thank you so much for listening. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. We are looking into the scandals of nuclear waste in Britain and America. Before we go to the nuclear waste fiasco in Great Britain with John Large, let's hear just two of the witnesses at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission hearing on December 2, 2013, in Perrysburg, Ohio. This was one of the 13 hearings held around the country. Free Speech Radio news reporter Evan Davis sent me the recordings and his interviews, which inspired this program. The majority of the public attending were strongly opposed to nuclear power, in numbers of speakers and volume of applause. First, we will hear a pro-nuclear argument, followed by a passionate voice against. Each speaker was given 3 minutes.
My name is Gary Border, and this isn't about me, but I think I should tell you a little bit about who I am. I have a PhD in electrical engineering from the University of Toledo, a couple of master's degrees, and started my college career at Case in Cleveland. I have mixed feelings on what I've heard thus far, but I think we've got to be realistic, folks. We've got a society here that has an appetite for electricity. I was on the Coast Starlight train a couple of years ago on family vacation, and early in the morning, the train stopped at Klamath Falls, Oregon, and a guy got on and asked if he could sit across from me at the club car. And it turned out to be a rail buff, and I had a just mile-by-mile tour. Look at this, look at that. It was fantastic. Turned out to be an IBM systems engineer from Salem, Oregon. After about 10 or 15 minutes of that, we got talking about other things, which I think is normal. And he said, "You're an electrical engineer. What do you know about power?" And I said, "Well, I'm digital, but I've been involved with power." He said, "Well, can you tell me where we're going to get power over the next 10 to 20 years? And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "We're running out of power." I said, "Well, I recommend nuclear." And he laughed. He said, "We tried that, and we built one plant, had some problems with it, just shut it down, turned off the lights, and locked the door." He said, "What do you think of wind power?" "Well, I live in Bowling Green, and I can tell you that wind turbines have their own set of problems. One of them is very simple. Once you get over about 20% of your power coming from wind turbines, the days that the wind doesn't blow is a real problem. You kill birds. There's all sorts of problems with wind turbines." Then he said, "How about solar cells?" I said, "Yeah, maybe in 50 years they'll be affordable." I said, "How about coal?" "They say with scrubbers." And he just laughed. He said, "No, we won't do that." He says, "They won't tear down Grand Coulee Dam and Bonneville Dam." Where are we going to get power? I just encourage everybody here to think about that. Think about global warming. We've talked about all this radiation. Okay? But global warming could kill everybody on this planet in 100, 200, 300 years. And if we keep putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and I'm not convinced that will happen, but it could. So you got to look for clean power. Right now, I don't see any choice. And I want to commend the NYC for working with a very difficult problem. And I encourage the NYC, in whatever is produced, to produce something that allows for responsible licensing, construction, and operation of nuclear power plants.
Thank you.
Now we'll hear from a younger woman at the NRC hearing in Perrysburg, Ohio.
Hello, my name is Jessica Muskena. Ladies and gentlemen of the NRC and the public, as a young person, I need to say to you, I have no confidence in the NRC's radioactive waste policy. For the many generations to come, I am angry that I get to inherit, along with my future children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and so on, and so on, and so on, and so on, the problem of deadly, permanent nuclear waste. Nuclear waste, as we all know, comes from reactors. This is an unnatural type of energy. The further we move away from natural types of energy, like wind, solar, geothermal, hydro, the more consequences that we are going to have. The enormous consequence of the most deadly man-made material on the planet is what we are faced with when we have nuclear energy. We cannot relicense or license any more reactors. We don't know what to do with the 76,000 plus tons in this country alone. We have nowhere to put this. The mass transportation of nuclear waste is a threat to the public. You cannot transport nuclear waste without accidents or spills. You cannot guarantee the public safety while doing so with this protecting people and the environment mission statement that you have. The probability of accidents are not low, as you say in your DGEIS, which Connie so greatly put it, has no substance, and it's been designed that way. It is inaccurate to say that the probability of accidents are low and dismiss it like this because the consequences of the accidents are not low. Look at Three Mile Island, look at Chernobyl, look at Fukushima. One nuclear accident can wipe out half the globe. To quote Yablokov and Nesterenko's book on the catastrophe of Chernobyl, that's one nuclear accident, such as the ongoing disaster of Fukushima Daiichi, with all of its spent nuclear fuel rods that are a million times more radioactive than when we put them in the core. This can wipe out the globe. This is not science fiction. This is the reality that we are dealing with. And this is the insane risk that we are taking when we allow the reactors to operate and produce radioactive waste. If you hold up to your mission statement, then you would see that nuclear energy is immoral. We are killing people with this type of energy. We are causing DNA mutations. We are causing horrific birth defects. Please research them. We are causing infertility, heart problems, immune deficiencies, and cancer, especially among the youngest of our population. That is immoral. Nuclear energy is an incalculable danger to the whole of creation for historic and geological ages. It is a transgression against life itself. It is infinitely more serious than any crime perpetrated by man. Nuclear energy is an ethical, spiritual, and metaphysical monstrosity. It means conducting economic affairs as if people didn't matter. And you will be seeing me again, I'm sure.
All right. Woo!
Radio EcoShock, bright voices in dark times. Get more, ecoshock.info. Next up, how does a nuclear waste problem in Great Britain compare to America?
Radio EcoShock.
What happens when you collect a lifetime of atomic waste on a small island in the North Atlantic? Nothing good. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is an accomplished nuclear engineer. He's advised teams raising damaged nuclear submarines, written reports for Greenpeace and Friends of Earth, testified as an expert witness. He's appeared on international media countless times. Radio EcoShock is pleased to welcome back Britain's John Large. Hello, John.
Hi.
Well, John, I'd like to focus in this interview on the never-ending problem of what to do with atomic waste. But first, tell us briefly about your testimony that helped close the San Onofre nuclear power station in California.
Well, it was relatively straightforward. Southern Edison, the operator, decided to change these very large components called steam generators in the power plant. They spent 30 years of operation. They were rattling, so they needed to be replaced. They put an order with Mitsubishi for around $500 million for four replacement units. Mitsubishi produced those, shipped them across from Japan, cut their way into the reactor, fitted these, and within a year, they'd shaken themselves to pieces. My job was to do the analysis and decide whether or not those plants could be repaired within the required safety margins. My opinion was it couldn't. But not because of my evidence, but generally what happened was Edison, the operator, threw in the towel and announced mid-last year that these plants will be closed down permanently. A very interesting victory for Friends of the Earth. This was the first time in my recollection that a group, an environmental group, has actually closed down nuclear power plants. So quite a success in that respect.
Hopefully, many more to come. I'd like to get back to the UK. Unfortunately, I remember the years when Great Britain dumped its atomic waste right into the Atlantic Ocean in rather flimsy barrels, I thought. And I shudder to think what happens when those barrels release their burden of uranium and plutonium. But now that's stopped, and partly due to Greenpeace, I must say. What is Great Britain doing with its nuclear waste now?
Nothing. It's in limbo. Effectively, Britain hasn't got a final waste strategy. It's leaving the generated waste at the situations, the locations where it's generated. So at the moment, if a nuclear power plant generates nuclear waste, other than some very low levels of nuclear waste, all of that waste has to be retained on the site of generation. The present government strategy is to determine a nuclear waste repository site by 2040 and to have that in place by about 2004-05. In the meantime, nuclear fuel that is accumulating, radioactive waste from operations of nuclear power plants is accumulating. And in total, at today, from its legacy of nuclear power research and development and operation, including for the decommissioning of nuclear power stations, the existing ones in the UK, not the new generation at the moment, Britain has about 4.5 million cubic meters of waste that will require long-term management. So a legacy which is assessed to cost around 70 to 100 billion pounds sterling. That's the legacy of nuclear power in the UK at the moment.
And John, talk to us about the risks of accumulating mountains of bomb-grade plutonium in the UK.
Well, there's another problem, because Britain in the late 40s decided to go alone on a nuclear weapons program. Look, the story was simple. America favored the enriched uranium route. Churchill approached the Americans and said, could they provide the materials because of the post-war shortages in the 40s to Britain? Could America provide those materials so it could go along the enriched uranium route itself? It required some very high-spec copper piping, which it didn't have. The Americans turned it down flat. They didn't want Britain joining the nuclear club, even though British scientists were shipped out to Canada at the beginning of the war and worked on this project with the Americans. So they were keen to come back to Britain and to actually develop their own nuclear weapon. So what happened very briefly was that because they were refused the enriched uranium route, Britain went into the plutonium route. It decided to produce a plutonium bomb, and that was its strategy. And to do that, it required to actually reprocess reactor fuel. And what we see in Britain is the gas-cooled reactor, graphite-moderated reactor, being developed, because that was an ideal plutonium breeder. But even the reactor program that we had, the civil reactors, which are doubling up for military production, even that wasn't big enough. So Britain went round the world in the 50s and 60s particularly, gathering up fuel reprocessing contracts to be completed at Windscale, which was renamed Sellafield. All of that activity of overseas fuel, domestic fuel, reprocessing, has produced one of the largest plutonium stockpiles in the world. We have about 120 tons of weapons-grade plutonium in storage at Sellafield at this moment. And that is a real problem because although we've gone along what's called the MOX route, the mixed oxide fuel route, to try and convert that plutonium into fuel for the thermal reactors, like the PWRs, that's not been successful at all. There's a great deal of difficulty in producing the very, very high quality required for MOX fuel to run in these reactors. So Britain really is embarrassed. It has 120-odd tons of fissile plutonium, which is an enormous safety and security threat that has to be looked after.
Is it true that the UK is taking in even more nuclear waste from abroad even today?
Well, it's still got its contracts. It's still taking on reprocessing contracts. And, of course, the deal's like this, that we take in the overseas fuel from Japan, Spain, Germany. That fuel is then reprocessed. That means the fuel is taken in, it's dissolved in nitric acid. Then it sort of goes through a solvent dissolution process, which picks out the plutonium. So it's a separation to extract the plutonium. Scouring the world for fuel and to reprocess the fuel results in three products. The plutonium, tiny amounts of plutonium for each ton batch of fuel that's reprocessed that goes into the fissile stockpile. High-level waste, which is usually vitrified into a glass slug that is sent back to the overseas country, and that comprises all the fission products. And then a mountain of intermediate-level waste, which is not fission product generally, but activated product, which Britain has to keep. And what it does, it says to the overseas country, look, instead of sending you tons and tons and tons of intermediate level waste back, what we do is we'll substitute a little bit of high level waste. So we'll keep back these great big bowels of intermediate level waste and we'll send you back a bucket full of high level waste. This is called substitution. Of course, the problem is that the overseas customer gets a small volume that it's required to manage for several hundred thousand years, and Britain retains a very large volume of lesser radioactive but still very long-lived, tens of thousands of years, intermediate-level waste. It's that waste, that intermediate-level waste, that's held back by this substitution mechanism that is now accumulating as a legacy for the British to actually manage in the long term.
What a great business. It's hard to see how that benefits anyone in the British public, but we won't even get into that. Now, John, I recently found out one of the things that's being advanced as a way to store this waste is to put it in dry casks, in cement casks. But I recently found out from a recording in the United States, these storage casks are not sealed at all. They have an intake and a vent. Are they releasing nuclear radiation or could water flow through them?
Well, that's the real problem, isn't it? Because when you talk about the lifetime, look, you can look after radioactive waste in two phases. You can have the institutional phase where there's some intervention required from mankind. In other words, you need to store it, cool it, have emergency systems if anything goes wrong. And then you have the post-institutional period where the waste can be put in its container down into a deep geological hole, sealed up, and left there forever and a day. The problem is with some of these wastes, the time scales that you have to prevent the waste reaching man's environment, in other words, the surface, say leaking in the depths of a geological repository about 600 metres deep, and then working its way through the geological barriers, that timescale is so long that it's virtually impossible to engineer an artificial containment or even use geological containments with certainty to ensure that some future generation doesn't receive a dose. And the real problem is that if you make a mistake in the packaging, the geological disposal, the location of the repository, if there's water migrating through it, then under these timescales, there's very little you can do once a mistake's been made. If you make an error and the waste gets out by a factor of 10 or 100 or 1,000 times faster, then there's no way you can stop this horse race completing its course.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with British nuclear expert John Large. We are talking about the building burden of highly radioactive nuclear waste. John, the American nuclear power plants have spent fuel pools, just like in Fukushima, but the American ones are bulging with high-level waste. Are British facilities similarly overloaded?
No, what has happened in Britain is this, is of course, because of this reprocessing aspect, most of the plants send their fuel. Once the fuel comes out the reactor, it goes into the spent fuel ponds for a period between 3 to 5 years. Then it trundles off by rail to Sellafield up in the northwest, where it's reprocessed or stored and reprocessed later on. So we have most of our reactors, apart from one or two, the fuel is contracted to be reprocessed. So we take away this major hazard from the nuclear plants and transfer it to a single plant, Sellafield. And in many ways, some people argue, and it can be argued confidently, this is, in terms of security, safeguarding the plant from malicious attack, for example, it's much better to have the radioactive waste in one location where you can beef up security rather than scattered around the country at 20 or 30 nuclear power plants. America has this problem. Of course, one of the problems is this, is that typically a nuclear power plant will produce about 30 to 40 tons of waste every 18 months to 2 years. And it will do that repetitively year after year after year that it's been operating. So the spent fuel builds up. What has happened in the United States is that the operators have eked out the life of the power plants and gone for extensions to life. They've modified and gone for a life extension, which means the power plants are now operating not for 25 years, but for 45 years and greater. That means that the original storage ponds are not large enough to take this ongoing accumulating waste, that was spent fuel that comes from the reactors. So what they've done is they've then reverted to high-density racking. That's where they cram more fuel rods, more fuel assemblies into the same space. And, of course, that introduces different types of hazards and different types of risk of release. And, of course, the major difficulty now of Fukushima is trying to safeguard particularly Reactor 4, the fuel pond, which is up there 4 stories at the top of that building. They're trying to unload that fuel now because that's a major risk. And what can happen at a nuclear power plant is that the amount of radioactivity actually stored in the water pond after a few years, relatively short years, after about 10, 12, 15 years, depending on the reactor plant, the radioactivity in the fuel pond is greater than the moderately long-term radioactivity in the operating reactor. But the problem becomes is that the reactor has got all sorts of secondary containment strapped around it, the containment dome that characterizes the architecture of a nuclear power plant, whereas the actual fuel ponds are relatively flimsy in their defense against an accident, and particularly a terrorist attack or an aircraft crash or whatever. So that is the present problem, the dilemma that the power plants have fallen into by going for life extensions.
And those spent fuel pools, they need to be cooled all the time, but what if the external power goes down or the generators fail to start and run out of fuel? What happens?
You have, generally on a power plant, it depends on what part of the cycle of the reactor refuel cycle you're in. Or indeed, if the reactor has been completely, the fuel core of the reactor has been completely discharged, about 110, 120 tons, has been put into the fuel pond on a temporary basis, while, say, the reactor is undergoing a 5-year or 10-year periodic inspection, then you have a lot of heat-generating fuel in the pond. Typically, you would have about between 10 and 20 hours before the water boils down in a pond. So if you lose your diesel generators, go for a station blackout where there's no alternate power, you lose your off-site power and your diesel generators, you have about 10 or 20 hours, depending on the plant, to actually make good that water shortage. Of course, if you lose the pond water by some accident, by some rupture of the tank or whatever, then the problem becomes very much more immediate and the fuel can overheat within a matter of 10, 20, 30 minutes, and then you can run into this very interesting reaction between the zirconium clad, the zircalloy clad, that's an aluminium of zirconium that clads the actual fuel itself, these very fine rods. What happens at in steam at high temperature, about 600 degrees C in a steamy atmosphere, is that the zircalloy tries to go rusty. And to do that, it strips the oxygen out of the steam and leaves hydrogen. So you now have a combustive, if not explosive, atmosphere around the fuel. And that was, of course, what happened to Fukushima. The fuel overheated. It went through a zirconium steam reaction, produced hydrogen, and the hydrogen did the damage.
Given what happened at Fukushima Daiichi, it's amazing that Britain is planning to build another new reactor. How far along are those plans, and who is opposing it?
Well, we have, at the moment, we have an announcement. We just had an announcement about a month ago that a plant in Somerset, Hinkley Point C, is to go ahead. That's two big reactors, two 1,600 megawatt reactors, PWRs built by the French. That's got the go-ahead. They will now trundle through their construction and commissioning phases and probably come in line in about 2020, be online. And there's another two reactors have now been announced for a part of Wales on Anglesey to be built by Hitachi, consortium Hitachi. So irrespective of Fukushima, the British government is committed to nuclear power at the moment because it makes up its mix of electrical generating capacity from the renewables like the windmills, turbines, air turbines, and nuclear power makes up that essential renewable, so it's committed to it. And quite frankly, I mean, some critics would say that they've turned a convenient Nelsonian blind eye to Fukushima. We we argue here that it's quite comical, really. We argue that the British regulatory system is far superior to that of anywhere else in the world. And after all, tsunamis don't really happen here, so there's nothing to worry about. Of course, what one conveniently forgets is the first major nuclear accident in the world was actually at Windscale, Sellafield, in the 50s.
Suppose, John Large, the public does wake up and wants this threat of nuclear power ended. Can it be done without putting the British public back into medieval times?
I believe so. I mean, if I was to say to my long-gone father, look here, Dad, today I used so many kilowatts of electricity. I mean, he was a modern man, he would be astonished at the amount of electricity or energy that I as an individual had consumed in my home. So there's a lot of fat to be cut off here. We could certainly take some control over how we use and particularly how we manage electricity. You know, look, I think every country has tried smart meters, white meters. Perhaps what we need to do is actually not give the public the choice of when it uses its electricity. We should perhaps take devices like washing machines, television, well, washing machines, and fit those with a smart chip that says, sorry, I've monitored, this chip is monitoring the electricity supply in your area. It's not a good time to do your washing, your laundry. So therefore, we'll hold you off. You can do it in 2 hours' time when I say. I think we've got to place some autonomy in the system that says to the public, no, you can't make the decision. We will make the decision. If we're able to micromanage our electricity consumption, our energy use, then the demand would come down.
Is there anything I haven't touched on that you would like to tell us about today?
Well, just terrorism, I think, is a real problem for us at the moment.
Right. Are British fuel pools, are they hardened against, for example, an airplane coming in?
What we have in Britain is a wonderful act of Parliament called the Freedom of Information Act, which enables us, the public, to ask questions of them, the government. And that question is often asked. You know, what resilience has been put into our nuclear power plants, particularly the fuel ponds, which are considered to be rather vulnerable? What resilience has been put in following 9/11 in the States and, of course, our own terrorist attack in 2007 on the tube systems? And under the Freedom of Information Act, there's one clause, one qualified exemption that says, well, the government doesn't have to tell you this if it affects national security. And that's what it says. We won't tell you because it would affect national security. So therefore, we don't know the extent to which the resilience, to the extent to which the surety of our fuel ponds has now been beefed up against our quite obvious terrorist threat. Well, look, one of the problems with terrorism is that our nuclear power plants were primarily designed to withstand accidents. And accidents are, by their very nature, accidental. They're not intelligent, intentional events. But, of course, a terrorist event is an intentional, intelligent event that seeks out the vulnerabilities of the system. And if that system is a nuclear power plant, it doesn't take much imagination or much resource for an individual, a terrorist, to find out the weaknesses of the plant. And in many ways, you're given hints of this by the system. The establishment will strengthen up those parts of the plant that it considers to be vulnerable. So there's a symbiotic relationship between the establishment, the state, and the terrorist, knowing full well that if you harden up the defense of one part, that means that's the strong part, you can move to another part, and so on and so forth. So it's a difficult area that we don't seem to be managing very well.
Our guest is the principal of the nuclear consulting firm Large & Associates. He's an expert witness and nuclear engineer with decades of experience. Find some links to his work in my show blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith, saying thank you, John Large, for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I suppose my opinion is no big surprise for listeners. My questions about nuclear power began in the 1970s. I then lived near a uranium mining town, followed by 8 years of research for Greenpeace in their anti-nuclear campaign. More recently, Radio EcoShock has done dozens of programs on dangerous nuclear reactors, especially following the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan. The very day of that accident, I issued an emergency warning podcast, which still stands the test of time. Radio EcoShock was among the first to call a triple meltdown at the site while the Japanese and American authorities were still misleading us. Even so, I was still shocked to find that the dry cask option for nuclear waste is so shoddy, so crazy. When they doubled the radioactivity of nuclear plant waste, they kept using old designs that were doubtful even for the lower levels of waste. The NRC testifies in court that nuclear fuel can be brought out of these casks and back into storage pools, but has never done it. They promised to do it in the 1990s, but then realized there are big unknowns and it would be too dangerous, as Kevin Camps told us. So it's just a 100-year stall, if that. We'll pass our dangerous waste on to our grandchildren? I cannot accept that. I cannot accept an industry that carries on with no solutions for the future and world-threatening risks for the present. That isn't an industry. It's a sign of extinction-level insanity. That's my opinion. What's yours? How will you act now that you know? Thank you, Evan Davis, for inspiring this program. You too can learn how to record public events to share around the world. We need more people doing that. I'm Alex Smith. Download our past programs at our website, ecoshock.org. Help us keep going if you can. Find links for this program in the show blog at ecoshock.info. While you are still free, please join me next week for more Radio EcoShock.